You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, today it's common knowledge about how contagious diseases are spread, but a lot of what we understand about the spread of diseases, the epidemiology of them, can be traced back to medical detective work that would make for a great novel if only it weren't true. 150 years ago this month, cholera swept through England, and it was described then as, quote, the most terrible outbreak of cholera which ever occurred in this kingdom. And one London doctor and anesthesiologist figured out how the disease was being spread. Now, he didn't end the epidemic. It was already on the wane. But because of his scientific sleuthing, he figured out that if a handle was removed from a communal water pump, people would stop drinking contaminated water. And he was the first to understand that diseases could be spread by water, and he changed the course of epidemiology. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about the life of 19th century Dr. John Snow and his contributions to medicine. He was also, get this, he was also the father not only of epidemiology, he was a renowned anesthesiologist. He gave chloroform to Queen Victoria twice to ease her childbirth, during her childbirth. So it's a whole other side to him we'll talk about. And if you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Nigel Paneth is a professor of epidemiology and of pediatrics and associate dean of research in the College of Human Medicine at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Dr. Howard Brody is a professor of family practice and in the Center for Ethics and Humanities and Life Sciences in the College of Human Medicine and professor of philosophy at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks a lot for having us.
You're welcome. Dr. Stephen Rackman is an associate professor of English and director of American Studies at Michigan State University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
It's an all-Michigan show this afternoon. Hope your football team does well tomorrow as well as you guys are doing. Welcome to Science Friday. Dr. Brody, let's talk about John Snow and his significant contributions to epidemiology and anesthesiology. How could he have done both things, and yet we don't know so much about him? I don't think you've asked anybody, who's John Snow, they could tell you very much about him.
Yeah, it's really interesting that this fellow who had such a critical role in 19th century medicine, when a lot of modern medicine was kind of just coming along and getting on the map, has been as neglected as he was, which is what led us to work on our project with him and write our book. But he began with a very strong commitment to scientific research as a young physician starting a career in London. And by chance, I think he started working on problems that had to do with lungs and respiration, and particularly the effects on the body of different gases. So when ether came along from America, and people heard this rumor that people inhaling ether could be rendered insensible and you could do surgery on them and they wouldn't scream and move around, he had the preparation to immediately see that as a scientific problem rather than as a curiosity, and to launch very, very quickly into a major series of experiments that allowed him very, very quickly to understand an awful lot of the science of anesthesia, and as well as to become a very skilled anesthetist. And then as he saw what was happening with gases and the effects of gases on the body, he was able to critique the dominant theory of his day that said that diseases like cholera are spread by some bizarre unknown gas in the atmosphere, and to realize that the gases he had studied scientifically often did not act in the fashion that this so-called miasma would have to act if that was going to be the way that the disease was spread. So he started looking around for a different way that cholera might be spread to deal with the major public health challenge of his day, and he was smart enough to put together what he knew about chemistry, what he knew about the effect on the human body of cholera, and what was known about how cholera was dispersed geographically over large distances to come up with a novel theory that relatively few people of his time had thought of.
So as you said before, that people thought that the diseases were spread normally, all diseases were spread through the air. No one could conceive that they could be traveling through water, correct?
There are just a very few people here and there had come up with ideas about diseases being spread through the mouth or through water supply, but It was certainly not the dominant theory of the day at all.
Mm-hmm. Nigel Paneth, he had the handle removed from that Broad Street pump in London, shutting down the water pump. And Howard Brody was talking a little bit about his motivation. But was there a seminal event that, you know, why he did that and just stood up one day and said, hey, let's get rid of that handle. That's it.
Well, we know that Snow had been, to some extent, preoccupied with cholera since the 1831 epidemic, the first European epidemic. He was then a 17-year-old apprentice working in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, and he was sent to a colliery to manage the outbreak, and he saw the devastation. Hit again in 1848. By then, he was now an established practitioner. He put his thoughts down mm-hmm. in writing, and he worked out a theory that was revolutionary at the time, that it was spread by the fecal-oral method. That is to say that the cholera evacuations, which are like water, can soil anything, and particularly if you're poor and have no hand-washing facilities, it's very easy for it to be spread. And from there, he reasoned that it could also easily get into the water supply. His critical point was that only cholera evacuations could contaminate water and produce cholera. It wasn't just dirty water or mm-hmm. or anything like that. And so when he lived near Broad Street, and when he saw this sudden spike, this was during a third epidemic, the 1854-55 epidemic, there was a sudden spike in cases just around Broad Street. He began making inquiries, began asking the families of people who died where their relatives had taken their water, and quickly he suspected it would be one particular pump. And he honed in on the Broad Street pump, and he argued with the Board of Governors the night of September the 7th, 1854. And they listened to him, and they took the handle off the pump the next day. And the legend says that the epidemic was stayed, but in fact the epidemic had already been declining because people had left the area principally.
And even though he knew there was something in the water, this was before the germ theory, right? Before Pasteur and all that, we just knew what it was, that the diseases were spread by germs.
Correct. From his epidemiologic observations, that is to say the distributional features of the disease and also what he understood about its clinical picture, its pathophysiology, he reasoned that this had to be something caused by some specific agent from outside the body that had the capacity to replicate mm-hmm. itself. He saw there was a period of incubation. You didn't get sick right away as you would with a poison. A day or two would have to pass. And he reasoned from this that it was something live, something very small. He suspected it had the structure of a cell, something like a cell. But he didn't make any real attempt to try to take that any further, to look in stool or other places to see if he could find that agent. He rather focused on the pattern of communication, and that was his great insight. And by focusing on the pattern of communication, understanding how it's transmitted, he was able to suggest ways of controlling the disease.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we think was special about Snow is that he had a great sense of which science in his own day was advanced and which sciences were relatively more primitive. And he was afraid that the kinds of sciences that would have allowed him to say, this is exactly what the cholera particle is, were the less advanced sciences, like microscopy, where they didn't have stains, for example, that they have today that allow us to identify bacteria. And so he was sticking with those sciences like chemistry and later on statistics that he thought were highly advanced and would let you get reasonably firm knowledge and avoid those scientific fields where he thought they were too primitive. So he was an extraordinarily focused investigator in using the scientific tools of his day in a very selective fashion.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Rackman, let's talk about Snow's contributions to anesthesiology. I mentioned at the beginning that he was not shy about using it. Tell us about how he used anesthesia. Did he invent it? Did he discover it? Was he the first to use it? Did he popularize it? What's his background here?
Well, I think the best way to think about what he did for anesthesia was that he put the use of anesthesia on a more precise scientific medical basis. Than he certainly didn't discover it.
Right.
Anesthetics have been known from ancient times. But the particular kinds of anesthetics that we associate with the real birth of medical anesthesia, ether and chloroform, were actually drugs that had been sitting on the pharmacist shelves for many years by the point in 1846 when they became discovered in the United States as effective agents for surgical pain. And so Snow didn't discover them, but what he did realize is that there were lots of people had made lots of assumptions about how they worked. that he saw were clearly false because they were volatile agents, and he had a background in chemistry, and his background in chemistry immediately allowed him to recognize that these, that many of the problems that people were experiencing with ether when it emerged, and in England it came over in sort of the winter, early winter of 1846. He saw it demonstrated. He saw that some people thought, well, maybe this doesn't work on certain constitutions. Certain individuals are susceptible to ether. He immediately did some experiments on animals and determined, no, it has a universal impact. It's really about the dosage. But what's happening is people are giving it to other people on, say, a lint napkin or a handkerchief or in a glass tube. And because its volatility is cooling down, they're not getting that much of the gas into their system. Hmm. So he immediately developed a test for this, and then he developed an apparatus, an inhaler, which he could use that could actually put a face mask over and regulate the amount of oxygen with the amount of gas being delivered, and began to control the dosage. And then once he advocated that, and by the way, he did this and published it freely in the London Medical Papers, so anyone who wanted to make their own apparatus or have it made could do so without charge, a stark contrast to the American side of things where they were trying to patent ether as a drug. He was giving this technology away. And then he began to control the dosage and figure out what certain dosages corresponded to certain symptoms, so loss of consciousness, respiratory function being subdued, and trying to figure out what were the risks involved with anesthesia based on how a wide body or wide population sort of react to the drug, and also on animals. And by doing that, by controlling the dosage and then coordinating it with a set of symptoms, he developed what he called degrees of anesthesia. Mm-hmm. And these correspond basically to the way we think about it today. And he also, as he went on, he began to develop the cardinal rule of how anesthetics of this kind work, which is that they're inversely proportional to their solubility in the bloodstream. And that notion of finding out what the solubility led him to start to look for what he called the quest for the perfect anesthetic, where he was looking for a drug that had the best combination of effects. Ether was very safe, but it made people sick, and it's flammable, and there are a number of risks with it. Chloroform was very effective, but it did cause problems with the heart and sudden death and overdose. So he was always looking for the rest of his career, basically, for what he considered a better anesthetic. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the life and the history of John Snow with this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday with my guests Howard Brody, Stephen Rackman, Nigel Paneth. They're all co-authors of a new book, Cholera, Chloroform, and the Science of Medicine, A Life of John Snow. It's out by Oxford University Press. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. So, Stephen Rackman, is there a link between his work on anesthesia and his links with cholera? Does it meet up someplace? Is there an aha moment or something?
Oh, I think there are a number of aha moments, but that is, Snow was sensitized by, as Howard had said just before, he was sensitized by his use of gases. Two things really happened. He knew that gases were inhaled very quickly into the system, and they went into the bloodstream, and they were released also through the system. He also recognized that certain elements could stay in the body in certain ways. And so he was very attuned to discrete pathways, and this sensitized him to the notion that any kind of disease like cholera would probably very likely not be transmitted through the lungs or inhaled in any way, because the pathophysiology of it didn't correspond to it at all. It was all concentrated in the gut. Some doctors looked at another consequence of it, of cholera, is that you get dehydrated. You lose mm-hmm. a lot of fluid, and so the blood gets thick, the bodies turn blue, and people sort of associated that with maybe there was a fever related to it or oxygenation.
Yeah, we're talking about John Snow this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Which says to me that he was very flexible. If he spent all this time thinking about gases and inhaling and, you know, and ether and chloroform, to make the switch to say, oh, my specialty is not involved here, it's water, it seemed to me that he had, you know, the ability to do that.
Absolutely. I think that that's one of the things that makes him so interesting. We use the phrase that comes from Pasteur about the prepared mind a lot in this book, and the notion that there's someone who's training allows them to see something or a possibility that others don't see. And I think that Snow's work with a very diverse population from anesthesia practice was an important factor in him being able to see the wide picture of how these diseases might be communicated.
We could add even stronger evidence for this. He wrote his first book on cholera in 1848 at the time of the second cholera epidemic, and he had formulated his ideas well enough that he thought that should another epidemic occur, as occurred in 1854, he had already some ideas about how he might try to figure out, or show, or actually I shouldn't say figure out, but rather demonstrate more conclusively that this is the way cholera is spread. And he learned in 1854, in late 1854, that the water supply of South London, this is now not the Broad Street part, which is above the Thames, below the Thames, that in some neighborhoods, two different water companies with very different qualities of water had their pipes laid. Virtually one house next to the other could be a very a completely different water supply. One water supply, Southwark and Vauxhall, came from the center of London, from the Thames, quite close to where sewage poured in. The other, the Lambeth Company, had moved its water intake far upstream, had much purer water. So if it was true that cholera evacuations getting in through the sewer into the Thames were the way in which the epidemic spread, all he had to do was compare the cholera mortality rates by house if he knew which was the water supply to each house. And he took this on in the summer of 1854, and actually the Broad Street outbreak interrupted what he was doing. He was in South London, then he heard about this outbreak, and he rushed up there to do a more detailed on-the-spot investigation of that outbreak. The Broad Street outbreak is very famous historically, but the South London experience, which demonstrated very conclusively that the rate of cholera was basically about 14 times higher if your water supply was from Southwark and Vauxhall contaminated rather than Lambeth, was probably the most important epidemiologic contribution.
Fascinating. We're going to have to take a short break, but we're going to come back and talk more with Dr. Howard Brody, Stephen Rackman, and also with Nigel Paneth. They're all from Michigan State University, and they're co-authors of a book, Cholera, Chloroform, and the Science of Medicine, A Life of John Snow, out last year from Oxford University Press. 150th anniversary this month of that famous pump handle in London. Stay with us. We'll take more of your questions. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the 19th century physician John Snow and his life in medicine with Dr. Howard Brody, Dr. Stephen Rackman, and Dr. Nigel Paneth, their co-authors of the book Cholera, Chloroform, and the Science of Medicine, A Life of John Snow. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. This whole idea that that Snow was able to decipher there was something in the water without actually knowing what that was in the water, that's still in place today. I mean, there are still instances in recent memory where people say, hey, you know, we don't know what the pathogen is, but it's still in there. Let's go look for it. Correct?
Yeah, I think this is a point really important to emphasize. Snow's book is called On the Mode of Communication of Cholera. And there are a few books, there are many, many books in cholera about that time, but very few focused on the mode of communication. And focusing on the mode of communication of a disease is actually one of the ways in which we really do control disease. There are many examples in medicine of understanding the mode of communication first, before we know what the agent is, and learning how to control it. A good example is HIV infection and AIDS. The AIDS syndrome was described in 1981. Within about a year or two, the Centers for Disease Control were issuing guidelines for control and prevention. And they were based, they said it's a sexually transmitted phenomenon, infection, and it's a bloodborne. They knew it was sexually transmitted from the studies that had been done in gay men, in which the epidemic was first reported, and they knew it was bloodborne because they started to see cases among hemophiliacs who received mm-hmm. blood transfusions. And based on that, understanding the mode of communication, they made recommendations before the virus had been identified, which was, of course, 1983 by Gallon, Montagnier, and others. And if you look at those recommendations before the virus was identified, they're pretty much the same as they are now. We now can test for antibodies, of course, so we're far ahead. It was valuable to have the agent. I'm not saying it wasn't valuable, but for SARS-2, the SARS outbreak in China, the first thing was to find out how was it spread, how could we prevent its spread, and we learned about its airborne transmission and its droplet transmission from observations made, as people said last year. I heard, in fact, someone from WHO using Victorian methods, using Victorian methods of epidemiology, exactly what Snow did, just making observations, figuring out how it spread, instituting control measures, and it was quite some time before they identified it as a coronavirus, as the agent.
Very Sherlock Holmesian, you know. We eliminate those things. Maybe there's a connection there. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Michelle in California. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I'm calling because I noticed that the three authors here all made comments about how Snow was really able to pick up on this idea that the cholera was spread by something that was shared. And I just recently read an article in the Harvard Business Week weekly newsletter that this is called low associative borders, where there's people that are basically not designed to look for the traditional patterns and things, but they really have this ability to look for things beyond what's traditionally recognized. And I wonder if you think that Snow had those low associative borders to really help him look beyond what was commonly accepted methods and means for the time. And I'll take my answer off
of that. Dr. Brody, want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, I think I would totally agree with Michelle. I think that's a great insight, and that's one of the things we became convinced of as we did more research, is that Snow was an interdisciplinary thinker, and we actually believe there's some analogies between the way he thought and the way 20th century thinkers described systems theory in the 1960s, 1970s, in that the ability to jump across these disciplinary boundaries but correlate information from the different scientific disciplines and not be hung up on any one single discipline or any one single approach was a hallmark of the way Snow approached this problem solving.
Let me take it a step further now. You know, if cholera was on the wane, how did he pin it down, or how did the local officials pin it down that the pump handle was the problem? If it was already on the wane, and also taking it the next step, was he an immediate, you know, like an Einsteinian overnight, you know, sensation? He's figured this out, and the world celebrated.
Well, the truth is that the pump handle story and the implication of the Broad Street pump was not widely accepted. The official Board of Health view was that that was not the cause of that particular outbreak. Mm-hmm. And Snow continued, his views continued to be not really accepted, or perhaps partially accepted. People accepted the notion that dirty water is bad for you, but not in the specific way that Snow understood it, that it had, no matter how clean it looked, if it was contaminated with cholera evacuations, it was bad for you. Mm-hmm. We think that acceptance came in the 1860s when the fourth outbreak of cholera occurred, and Snow was by then dead. He died young of a stroke at 45 in 1858. But people who had initially disagreed with him began to look at the data from the 1866 epidemic, and it became very quickly apparent that waterborne outbreaks were occurring. There was a particularly large one in North London this time, and steadily his views became the norm. He was particularly strongly influential in the United States, where we can find many cholera writers of the 1860s and 70s citing Snow's work very, very positively. And in the UK, he was less well accepted on the continent, and German thought lagged very far behind and did not accept waterborne transmission until early in the 20th century, and in fact suffered some terrible outbreaks of cholera in the 1890s, by which time there were no such outbreaks really in the U.S. and Great Britain.
Even after Pasteur was around, huh? I mean, he didn't get any boost from that.
Well, more than Pasteur. In Germany, you had Koch, who was perhaps even more influential, and he certainly accepted the notion of waterborne transmission, but there were other scientists who thought otherwise. And it's important to remember that when Pasteur and Koch came up with germ theory in the 1860s and 70s, they too were not immediately accepted. It took some time. I would argue that physicians in general didn't accept germ theory as a given until probably the turn of the century.
Still the vapors.
Well, you do see, I think, in the United States in the 1890s, the development of public health organizations that have microbiology labs, and once that starts to happen, it's uneven in its development. But once that happens, you start to see a sea change. But it was by no means a given that Snow's work would be accepted. And really, it was in 1866 with the Board of Public Health recognizing officially that Snow was right, and that they started to remove handles of pumps at other locations in London, and then it became widely known that this happened, and the head of the public health system in London acknowledged this, that John Snow's reputation sort of as a gumshoe detective epidemiologist became lore. And by that point, though, you know, he was dead, of course, and his family, which, you know, we haven't really emphasized this, but he was the son of a carter, or its obscure origins, and his rise to prominence as someone who would give chloroform to the Queen of England is a really remarkable trajectory of social mobility from, you know, maybe a working class environment with a few connections to becoming a prestigious and well-known doctor going to levees at the Queen's behest. But then, right after he dies, his sisters fall into penury, and the members of the British Medical Association take up a petition to get them a pension on behalf of their brother's work. And it's really at that point in the 1860s that you see a clear recognition of Snow as a national figure who did national service. And it's not for his anesthesia work, which he was widely known. It was for his cholera contribution.
Did his work make it over the pond here to this country and find more acceptance? Or
not only did it make it over in terms of cholera, sure. Yeah. In terms of anesthesia, he actually was in contact with American physicians sending drugs. There was a drug called amyline. I think we think of it as, you know, a lot of these fluorocarbons that he would be using. They're carbon-based volatile agents. He was experimenting with amyline, and for a while he believed that this was a very effective anesthetic until he lost two patients with it. But he actually sent it to a doctor in New York. And so he was not only sending his work over, which became sort of standard work on these anesthetics, but he was also sending agents over for people to try on patients.
I'd like to add one thought, if I may, Ira, that just parking back to the question from California. Even though we're university faculty, we can say that Snow didn't allow an education to get in the way of his genius. He left school at 14. He's virtually entirely self-taught. He returned to take the kind of medical education that was available, which were really not so much going to school as taking specific courses in the 1830s. But one of the astonishing parts of the Snow story is his very humble origins in a working-class family in York, large family, apparently deeply religious from what we can reconstruct, mother born out of wedlock, and rising to as far as he did in the medical profession without the benefit of really much in the way of formal education.
Talking this hour about John Snow with the authors of the book Cholera, Chloroform, and the Science of Medicine, A Life of John Snow, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the lines. Is that Gene in Phoenix?
Hello, Ira.
Oh, I guess not. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm hitting a memory thing here. Jay Bernowski had a series back on the original Ascent of Man PBS series.
Oh, you're dating yourself now.
Yeah, well, I'm just retiring.
That was the early 70s, I think, like 71 or 2. I remember that series. It was terrific. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Okay, I remember something about the spread of cholera in England. Is this the same effort?
Any of my guests remember that series? I think it was.
I believe that Bernowski did have a piece on Snow, a brief piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Great.
Right. There have been other TV series done since then on. This is very famous. Did they know in those times that if they even though they didn't know what was in the water, that they might try to sterilize it or boil it or filter it or do something to get it out of the water?
Well, let's go back a little bit and say something sort of interesting about Snow's background. And I want to give credit to one of our authors who's not here today, Peter Vitten Johansson, who's actually the first author of the book. He's our historian colleague, and he's a fanatic for getting all the possible information you can and always going back to the original source. So Snow became a vegetarian early in life. And when he was still an apprentice in the north of England, he adopted a vegetarian diet. And his biographer of 1858 told us the title of the book that he read that converted him to vegetarianism. So everybody before us who wrote about Snow just sort of added this as a little, oh, isn't that quaint? He became a vegetarian. But they didn't see any possible connection between that and his cholera theory later on. So our colleague Peter went to the MSU library and actually found that we had a copy of this 1811 book by John Frank Newton on vegetarian diet, and he read it, and he found out that what Newton was saying was, beware dirty water. That what you really want to do, because water is so impure, if you drink water at all, you want to distill it. So Snow actually became an advocate early in life of distilled water, and he got it from reading this book about vegetarian diet, and so that really was a little piece of his early background that predisposed him later. He never ever used that as any kind of proof, but because he was sure that if he was going to prove it to the world, he could never cite this book. He had to get data, and of course, as Nigel said, in South London, he got the more definitive data showing that there was such a huge difference between cholera in people who drank the sewage contaminated water compared to cholera in people who drank the pure water, that there was a very, very strong correlation there. That was what he thought was the definitive proof. But in terms of his own predilection toward thinking about impure water as a source of disease, clearly he'd had that idea planted in his head quite early in life. But then, of course, he had to add the idea that Nigel also highlighted and Steve mentioned, which is it isn't just dirt in the water. It's this very specific kind of particle that has to come from some other patient who has previously had cholera.
Yes.
And something that you couldn't see. I mean, wouldn't his critics say, hey, yeah, you can't see it. It's clean. You know?
Yeah. Well, he called it a special animal poison. And I think that's a very interesting phrase to use because he was very careful about his phraseology. And that idea of a special animal poison was sort of a term where it acted like a poison, but it had to come from animals, and it was special in the sense that it was from species to species, and that it only engendered itself. And so that notion that, yeah, certainly dirty water was far too large a category to describe how specific this infection was. And cholera could strike, you know, very quickly, and it had a kind of specificity that was undeniable even to people who were predisposed to not agree with that.
Gentlemen, I've got to interrupt. We've run out of time. I want to thank all of you, Stephen Rackman, Nigel Paneth, Howard Brody, all from Michigan State University, all co-authors of the book Cholera, Chloroform and the Science of Medicine, A Life of John Snow. Very interesting. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
You're welcome.
And have a good weekend. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick, Paul Masiello, Enrico Cardi in New York, Elliot Brennan in Chicago, Russ White and Kevin Epling in East Lansing. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Malesky and Alphonse Vinn. Have a great weekend. We're going to be next week in San Antonio. So if you're out in San Antonio, surf over to the Texas Public Radio website and you can come in and join us in the audience. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.